guests today are a trio of economists, and there's a bit of a backstory with them, so hopefully you'll spare me. But I was doing research on team chemistry. I was writing my dissertation. I was presenting at conferences. And I thought, you know what, this information isn't out there. I think maybe this could be an interesting book. I talked to Ben about it. We kind of put this idea for a book together. And then we thought, well, wait a sec, wouldn't it even be cooler to have a book that could be like a one-stop shop for team chemistry and get together with other psychologists and put these theories together? And as I was doing research about other theories, I came across this trio of economists. And I thought, what do economists know about team chemistry? This is a psychology topic. What are they talking about? And I read the article that they put out there, and I was impressed with it. And fast forwarding a little bit, I contacted them and said, would you guys like to write a book? And somehow, I don't know how, they agreed to it. And then again, they agreed to be on our crazy podcast.
Sheer stupidity, obviously.
Yeah,
bad cost benefit analysis.
Economists. We didn't promise we were good economists.
Right. So anyway, I'll pass the baton to them. I'll let them introduce themselves, and then we've got some hard-hitting questions on a really interesting theory about how they went about measuring team chemistry. So I'll let you guys take it away.
So my name is Andrew Butters. I'm currently an assistant professor at the Indiana University, the Kelley School of Business. Outside of being an economist at IU, I'm Chicago sports fan through and through. So go Cubs, Bulls, Blackhawks, the whole shebang. And I think as you'll see in terms of the most motivation for our work and sort of what's come out, I think the sort of Chicago sports themes will come out and play out really nicely. Other thing, just personally, so I'm just had a my wife and I just welcomed our second child, 3-month-old now. So like fighting the fatigue and the sleep still. So you'll have to.
I'm surprised you're here, that. Dude. That's impressive.
Yeah. So
congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. Congrats.
Scott Brave. I'm also an economist. I work at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. That's actually where Andrew and I met a long time ago. Also a big time Chicago baseball fan, Cubs fan, even though I grew up in the St. Louis area and took a whole ton of shit growing up and not being a Cardinals fan, but a longtime Cubs fan, suffering Cubs fan until the last few years. And you'll see it. That was actually a pretty big inspiration for how we got started on this project.
Blasphemy.
Yeah. My wife's from St. Louis. Her family would have your fucking head, man.
Yeah. Mine too.
Yeah, so I'm Kevin Roberts. I'm a PhD candidate in econ at Duke University. So I'm a North Carolina native, but I also got connected with Scott and Andrew working at the Fed, which I started working at for 2 years before my PhD in 2015. And I was a kind of a North Carolina sports fan, Panthers, Duke basketball, and had never really been into baseball. And so I moved in 2015 to Chicago, about 10 minutes from Wrigley, and just kind of became a Cubs fan. I heard something about their history, but from my perspective, second year as a fan, we win a World Series, no big deal. Move on.
Pretty strong,
dude. So I think from that perspective, I was just getting into baseball, and you know, if you're from any kind of social science quantitative background, it's very easy to eventually kind of get hooked on the analytics stuff. So my roommate at the time was a Cardinals fan, and kind of a lifelong St. Louis guy, and he just kind of had to put up with me just being like, yeah, I mean, like Dexter Fowler getting a lot of RBIs in there, pretty good, right? And then he would kind of like baby me about how the sort of stats that really mattered. So I think kind of from that standpoint, kind of looking at the analytics has always been kind of connected with that. And continuing to be a Cubs fan to this day, and really kind of getting hooked on baseball.
Without aging Kevin and I too much, I also lived about 10 minutes away from Wrigley Field when I started my position at the Fed, and I can tell you that the winning percentages were not at all what Kevin experienced.
But they
just about right.
They ended up winning a World Series since Kevin has been a fan, so you're welcome, Chicago.
That sounds like causation.
That's what I'm really trying to say is, we're the economists. We know causality. That's what happened.
X causes Y. Kevin moves to Chicago, win the World Series. It's a wrap.
There you go.
All right, so let's dive into this. I think we have a handful of questions, and you guys have a very interesting, but I think a very detailed theory that I want to give you guys an opportunity to explain. And as I mentioned off air, that I'm going to hold you to like I'm a drunk sports fan at a bar saying, listen, smarty pants economists, you're going to need to break this down for me. So let's start this off. Give our audience a bird's eye view of your team synergy is what you've called it, your team synergy project. What inspired it?
Sure. So I can kick that off. So actually, I was at the 2016 MIT Sloan conference. Sitting there for the first time, never been to a sports analytics conference. It was definitely a fish out of water for sure. But sitting there listening to everyone talk, and you know, I expected to hear a lot of Moneyball type stuff because that's kind of how I got exposed to analytics. And I was hearing all this discussion about team chemistry, and I'm like, wow, I thought that was something that was poo-pooed, and we don't talk about those kinds of things. But really, it was front and center, and I can really say it was a comment that Gary Bettman made. The NHL commissioner, he was basically kind of saying to all the analytics folks in the room, is like, what you guys do is great, but you know, team chemistry, that's where it's at. And you guys can't measure it, you know, and as long as you can't measure it, you know, does it really matter for a sport like hockey where, wow, it really matters how teammates interact with each other. Those interactions are fundamental to how the game is played and, you know, who wins and who loses. So I took that kind of as fighting words. It should be something you should be able to measure. Economists, we talk all the time about how inputs and outputs interact with each other. And sometimes you get more out of inputs than you would expect if you just add A and B together. Sometimes it's A times B. You get a multiplier of things. That fits very well with this notion of what team chemistry is. It's putting individuals together and trying to get, you know, something more out of the whole than you would from the individual parts. And so that's kind of how we always viewed it. And that's kind of where we took off. I came back and I begged Andrew to start working on this. Andrew and I have worked together on a lot of different projects over the years and talked his ear off, got him interested. Turns out it fits well with his, a lot of the work that he did for his dissertation, measuring productivity. And Kevin was a research assistant there at the time too. We were working very closely on other things. And as soon as I found out he was interested in baseball, the Cubs, it was, you know, off to the races. Just had to figure out how to do it, how to make it work.
I guess, can you next sort of get into a little bit more what exactly team synergy is, right? I think we've talked a bit about team chemistry. Why team synergy? Can you just boil this down for us? How exactly does this work?
Yep, it's a great question, Ben. I'm going to go into a little bit of the details of sort of our approach, and I'm going to punt a little bit on the distinction between synergy and chemistry. And what I hope to get to at the end of it will be sort of all teasing aside, that the distinction is not really substantive at all. It's really more the reaction that we got in terms of putting the work out there. So as Scott alluded to, really the crux of this is that we were all three of us coming at this problem that was very, again, front and center in the sports analytics conference that Scott attended, of thinking about how the interdependencies amongst players could result in what is perceived, at least amongst popular press or sports fans or again, anyone who's watching the game, as above expectation performance. And so, you can think about this in the context of economics very naturally in terms of just thinking about productivity. So, you know, we think about firms collecting different sorts of inputs. So in this case for baseball, it'd be, you know, combining a bunch of different players to produce wins. You know, in the economy, we think about combining labor and capital and maybe materials and producing output. And of course, a key principle in economics is just that the rate at which those inputs substitute for one another or complement each other really translates into differences in what you might expect the output of those firms or those units in the economy to produce. And so, you know, we thought this is actually like really natural to think about how baseball teams are producing their output wins, and by combining a shortstop and a first baseman and a center fielder and, you know, mixing them all together and then ultimately producing a hopefully an effective team. Now, of course, what's great about baseball is that all those in, so for economists, you know, like we struggle with this all the time. It's like, man, we just really wish we could have better data. You know, we can't, it's hard for it to run experiments. It's hard for us to get really good measures of all these sorts of key outcomes that we want to think about. And baseball is not at all that way. So in some respects, we were sort of like kids in the candy shop and just like walking in here and all of a sudden we've got, look, all of these really great individual metrics of players, which are the inputs that are going into this team outcome of wins. And so what we just thought about was like, okay, well, let's just think about what's the unexplained variation in team performance conditional on what, like win above replacement combination they had amongst their individuals. And it's incredible, but like 20% of the variation in team wins year to year, just totally unexplained by what those collection of players were. And so that really started, that was like the key. That was like, all right, that's the residual that we want to explain. Because if this claim is that, you know, there's something out there that you guys really aren't doing very well at explaining, well then this, it's gotta be some of that, right? It's gotta be some of the above or below average performance conditional on what this mix of individual win above replacements would be. Now, again, I want to side table like all the qualms that people have about win above replacements and all that sort of stuff, but that's the residual. That was what we were trying, yeah, that we were really after. And then of course, then the second piece of this is just, all right, now the inputs, there's interdependencies there. The shortstop, having a good shortstop means something only to the effect that you have maybe a pitcher that's going to produce ground balls. And again, that was one that got us into a big back and forth with some people, or having a really dominating third hitter is going to be important if you have people getting on base. And so we just saw this really unique opportunity to provide the lens of what economics sort of is all about in terms of thinking about substitution amongst inputs as then trying to provide the framework. And so, and then the mechanics of it really became kind of something that is really much in Scott's wheelhouse as well as Kevin's, which is just the empirics of this really fit really naturally into like a network type approach where you model the interdependencies across these inputs. You've got, we have that residual that we're trying to explain. And so by seeing individuals or players show up on teams or show up in positions of teams that are by and large more and more showing up as above expectations relative to what the, you know, set of individuals were, well, then that's going to be someone that our approach is going to label as a good synergy player. And so then I think really what then came out of it was just we had a bunch of nice results. Some of them were consistent with our prior. So like David Ross, I know his name hasn't come up yet. He was the titular player in the original paper. He was obviously front and center in the popular press during the time that we were working on the project. And, you know, there were some things that were consistent with our priors with David Ross, and then some other things that came out as well that I think like really gelled the whole project together. But that's really sort of the crux of this. It's how does on the field performance that is unexplained by what these great advanced individual sabermetrics could explain, that we can then systematically relate to, again, the prevalence of this individual showing up team to team or year to year in producing. And so that's why I wanted to caveat like the synergy chemistry things, because of course, like we came across this really at some level thinking about it as productivity. Like this is just the unexplained residual. It's the measure of our ignorance right now that we want to explain. And, you know, of course it was motivated because it's attached to this chemistry, this idea that it's the sum that's greater than, you know, the sum of all of its individual parts that I think we were naturally attached to. It was, I think, everything that came after it and what Kevin had to experience, which I'm sure he'll get into, and what Scott experienced and what all of us experienced sort of as we were talking with people, that just had us transition and sort of having to fit it into to synergy. But again, we very much see it or consider it as chemistry or this unexplained part of performance that we were able to try to explain.
This actually, that made a lot of sense, and I just want to unpack that. So let's take, I'm trying to think of like an average or below average fielding shortstop, like a, and I'm going off the top of my head, like Carlos Correa. Good offensive player, Can we agree that I think his defense is decent? Yeah. So the premise of team synergy here is that Carlos Correa is a, let's just call him a decent infielder. And then all of a sudden, Justin Verlander joins the Astros. And having Justin Verlander as your pitcher suddenly makes your job a lot easier, a lot more soft hit ground balls, you know, less line drives at your face or, you know, one hoppers or all that stuff. And that's what you're really getting at. You're boiling it down. You're not saying like, this is not a player in a vacuum, because WAR, the measure of any one player, right, is any one value. And statisticians and everyone else out there says, look, all we need to do is just add this stuff up. But these guys aren't in a vacuum, that there's overlap in terms of performance and everything that's going on between players. And your theory takes that overlap and measures it. Did I get, is that the gist of it?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. No, that's 100%. 100%. And just to piggyback off of that example that you just gave, Brett, Justin Verlander's impact on a shortstop is likely to at least potentially in our approach to show up differently than Justin Verlander's impact on maybe a left fielder. And now, we're going to let the data speak for itself in that regard. So, yeah. You know, there's obviously assumptions that are built into the model. You know, I'm confident we don't want to go through all the mechanics of how we, you know, built the network matrix and all the such, but the point would be, you know, we're going to let that residual be what we are trying to explain. And let the data speak to, you know, how systematically does Justin Verlander show up on a team or a year where, conditional on the team's set of individual WARs, the team outperformed that. And if Justin Verlander consistently shows up on those teams or several years in a row with, again, different mixes of players, different mixes of WARs, that, like, man, well then, okay, then whatever he's doing must be spilling over in a way that the sabermetrics or the individual WAR measures aren't capturing. And okay, now we'll let the data say that that's going to be now part of the chemistry that Justin Verlander provides.
And this is, based on the description that we're talking about, it sounds like a lot of this is contingent on the player, because how does the shortstop and the right fielder really overlap much, right? It's sort of position specific, right?
Yeah, we built the network matrix taking into account defensive positions and lineup positions. So that was kind of, we limited ourselves right to that, you know, the two fundamental ways that players interact on the field. And so, you know, those kind of interactions and really repeated interactions are what's driving that correlation. But one thing I do want to add, because this was the big criticism we got, right? So we very much focused on how the game is played and how the pieces fit together. But there's actually nothing in the way that we measure things that precludes something like clubhouse chemistry from also filtering into what we're showing up, right, or measuring. Yeah. You know, we're not directly measuring off the field interactions, but, you know, it's probably the case that these guys that we identify as having strong on the field connections,
yeah,
have strong off the field connections as well. And as long as that manifests itself on the field and improved performance and wins, yeah, you know, we can potentially capture that. So,
yeah,
you know, that was the big criticism we got from the very beginning. It's like, well, this isn't chemistry. This is not clubhouse chemistry. I want the rah, rah stuff in the,
yeah,
you know, in the dugout in the clubhouse.
Yeah. That seems like almost like an ignorant perspective, though. It's like, I would assume, having played sports, having studied this stuff, that there's a connection between that real chemistry that occurs in the clubhouse and the chemistry or interdependency, if you want to call it that, synergy, whatever it is, that's happening on the field, right? That's like saying the fact that D Wade and LeBron are super good buddies doesn't translate to how they play together on the court, right? Like, that's,
yeah, you know, certainly. Yeah, definitely. And that was kind of the way we always responded. And then, you know, the weird thing about it was they would come back with, well, your measure actually, it doesn't capture all chemistry, because if it's something that doesn't actually lead to wins, it's not going to show up. And our response was, if it doesn't lead to wins, why does it matter, right?
Why are you measuring it? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, these articles that get written, and I forwarded one around to everyone this week, because there was one that came around again about the Tampa Bay Rays. You know, they always come up in the context of winning. You know, yep. Winning is what matters, and people are trying to understand why certain teams win and others don't. So, you know, we started with wins, right? Team wins. It's got to show up there first, and we worked our way backwards. But I think for a lot of people, they saw that as you know, something that was kind of out of whack, that, you know, that was something that suggested that we were doing, you know, creating, pulling stuff out of thin air. They want to build it up from the bottom up, you know. So
I was just saying, can I ask one more follow-up? So when Brett and I have talked about team chemistry before, we talk about it at both an individual player level and as a team, sort of their added chemistries, if you will. Do you guys also look at it in this way? Like, is it a multi-level kind of thing happening?
Yeah, and actually that's where a lot of the work that Kevin did was crucial. So we started at looking at the team level, and then it was sort of like, okay, how do you bring it back down to the individual players? And that's really the crux of the model is building it down to the sources, trying to figure out which are the players. When you put them together and you add things up, you get something, you know, unexpected. And yeah, I think for Kevin, a lot of the pushback that he received when he went to Sloan the next year in 2017 to show this off was actually more about the players, right? Because when you go down to that level, now you're inviting all kinds of controversy, because, you know, the chances are somebody's favorite player is not going to look good. Kevin can talk all about that.
I mean, the thing I would add to that is just that I think in a lot of ways, chemistry is sort of the catch-all for people in terms of what they don't know about sports. And so people are kind of fast and loose with how they apply it. And so when you talk about players, you know, part of what makes sports fun is that you get these personal attachments to players. And, you know, like most of sports media is just kind of like drumming up these impressions people have about the personalities and their performance. And so it's just kind of a very ripe ground for people to apply their idea about how things work. So when you kind of come in and try to provide a little bit of structure, a little bit of organization about what we're doing, you know, if it goes along with what people already thought, they're great with it. But if not, they're gonna be a little harder to get on your side.
I love the way that I think Scott broke this down. Ben asked that question, was that you started it at the group level, you started at the team level, but you can break it up into individual pieces. And I'm just sort of thinking on like fan graphs in the future, that every individual player can have a team synergy measure to say, like, if you want to know what type of chemistry this guy can bring, here it is, because we've calculated it based on Justin Verlander 2016, 2017, 2018, and we can boil it down, which I think is really elegant. I really like that. The other piece we mentioned earlier was this idea of it's kind of a pop culture definition. It really ends up being a dichotomy, I feel like, because when people say team chemistry, I think they do refer to what you guys have measured. I think they do refer in part to synergy, right? We talk about this, and we talked about this on the last podcast, that like people will refer to chemistry when they discuss the rhythm between a quarterback and a wide receiver. And I think what you guys have really captured is the rhythm between maybe, let's say, a pitcher and a shortstop, right? I think that's part of it. But to Scott's point, there's also, and I think a lot of other people are interested in that rah-rah, and I think as one of you wrote, the high five and the butt slap stuff. Clubhouse chemistry. And I think what this has really told me, and I think what is great for the book, is that Ben and I have spent a lot of time writing and researching the rah-rah stuff, the clubhouse stuff. And I think you guys have really spoken to the rhythm stuff, the capture between the two players, whether it be a quarterback or a wide receiver, in this case, you know, catchers and pitchers or whomever. And I think that's really, I think this is awesome in terms of speaking to both of those sides. So if someone picks up our book in the future, they can't complain and be like, well, what about this? It's like, I feel like, pardon the metaphor, but we're covering all of our bases, which is great. let's move this forward. Next question here. So along the lines of what we're, you know, I think where this is headed, and I think this is really interesting. I think the way that you guys have explained this is elegant. I think that there's some potential here. How can teams, organizations, and or coaches use this to their advantage?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the conversation we just had is kind of a natural lead-in. So I think really at its core, the way that we envision this is that this can kind of be used as sort of a tool for player evaluation that can kind of give the teams that are, I guess, sort of willing to take the jump and buy into this sort of a competitive edge in their roster construction. And, you know, so like you said, kind of one of the things we do is we take these individual measures like WAR and we can sort of adapt them and modify them to take account of these chemistry effects. And so it's not just kind of looking at individual players and saying, okay, this player counted for this many wins in terms of their chemistry or synergy contribution, but also just kind of trying to flesh out really like what the profile of these types of players look like if you're looking for chemistry. And I mean, I think, you know, to really get at kind of how this hopefully will happen sooner rather than later, you just go back to kind of the original sort of Moneyball revolution, which was just an issue of, you have this very kind of stable established wisdom about how you evaluate talent. You've got some really simple statistics. You mainly are relying a lot on scouts and interviews. And all it really took was someone to come along and say, hey, if this all is wrong, then we can kind of get this leg up and not just get good players, but get them for cheap. Because, you know, kind of the reality of a lot of this and a lot of kind of when teams take this step is just a reaction to these financial realities, especially small market teams looking for that edge. So, I mean, I think, you know, jumping forward 20 years, the place we're at now is that those same kind of tricks that worked 20 years ago obviously aren't going to work now. You still have the stragglers who are sort of resistant to the analytics approach, but you can't just kind of use on-base percentage or whatever to get that leg up. You really need that next step. And then, you know, that kind of goes back to what I said before, is that I do think even at the professional level, chemistry in a lot of ways is the catch-all for what we don't understand. And, you know, one of the things we found is, I think just in general that, you know, we would all agree that most teams are looking for chemistry. This seems pretty obvious that this is an objective that they have. And one of the kind of encouraging things that we found with our results is that we actually looked at our measures and we looked at how they related to salaries and free agency and what teams were actually paying. And so at some level, it did seem like teams are kind of capturing some of this to an extent, especially when you think about kind of the observable ways that chemistry manifests itself. We find that older players tend to be better on these dimensions, different positions. Mm-hmm. But then once you kind of control for that stuff, there's this big chunk we call intangibles, which is the stuff that we don't know about yet. So again, I think it really is just an issue of, you know, who is willing to take that leap. This really is kind of the next frontier for how, you know, we're kind of running out of space in a lot of ways because of how much we've done with analytics to find those edges. And so hopefully what we've kind of done is really put some discipline on how we think about chemistry so that if the right team comes along to really start applying these, they can get a big advantage.
Hell yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. We 100% support. I mean, Brett and I have had conversations with countless teams about helping them to measure, manipulate team chemistry. And it's always like, yeah, this is cool. This is cool. This is cool. And then they're like, oh, we have to pay you for this? Like, see ya. It's like, okay, great. We have PhDs. Like, of course you have to pay us. The follow-up I guess I have is, what's the concrete first step then that a team would need to take? Like, let's say I'm the we're Giants fans. Let's say I'm the Giants and I'm like, man, Farhan's here. We really need to make some improvements, get rid of some of these old guys and take the next step. What's the concrete first step that they could take?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, one level of it is that, you know, some of what we are capturing is going to be kind of captured in coaching. So I think, you know, ultimately it is up to the organization to figure out how to put these pieces together. But like anything, you know, I guess the promise of analytics is that it can really kind of merge and complement these sort of traditional approaches. So, you know, I guess I hesitate to just say it's a leap of faith, but I think what we would all argue is that, you know, there's a lot of stuff in our work that should make you realize you're on firm ground. Like I said, kind of showing that some of the stuff is priced in. It looks like, you know, a lot of our, what we think about chemistry is showing up, but, you know, that's not really useful for you if you're trying to get that edge. You really do need to kind of take a jump. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's kind of, at least maybe before I went and presented this and talked to other people about it, what I really viewed kind of this top-down approach as really the advantage of our paper, because it's easy to kind of see the obvious linkages kind of pop up, like with a pitcher who produces ground balls and good fielders. Mm-hmm. But, you know, ultimately, we'd like to actually be able to understand kind of beyond that and kind of what we're familiar with. And I think that's kind of the promise of, I hope, what we're doing is to really, really kind of pin down exactly what we're looking for with chemistry. So we kind of know where to look and can continue kind of pushing things forward with our understanding.
I think there's a market for it for sure. I think people would, why isn't your phone ringing right now?
Serious question.
Well, we did have some interest after Sloan. You know, there were some people that contacted us, and you know, at least one of the people that did, we were pretty sure was directly involved with the team. And you know, there was a lot of discussion. I think a lot of the issue comes back to the player component of this. So just from that experience, I think we learned if our analysis doesn't necessarily confirm that their archetype player for this, you know, looks the way that they think they should look, that's going to be a little bit problematic, right? So, you know, saying David Ross kind of fits the bill here as this intangibles guy, nobody was really going to disagree with us on that. And our analysis confirmed that. But, you know, there are some other players that I think have a reputation of being glue guys or chemistry players that, you know, our analysis didn't necessarily look at so kindly. Hmm. We looked at that as, you know, okay, well, that might suggest that maybe the way we're looking at things is missing something potentially. We can go deeper with this. But sometimes I think at the superficial level, that was enough to close the door. That said, I do think there were some organizations that did kind of take this notion. We threw out a number, Kevin did when he presented at Sloan, that we said, you know, the best chemistry players are worth something around the order of 1.5 wins in a season, which is a big number, right? Yeah. That's the best chemistry players, right?
Yeah,
so that's like that's the Mike Trouts of the world, essentially, right? Yeah. But we threw that number out there, and I do think that got some people's attention. You know, and the other thing that we found in our analysis is it's the star players that do the most of this work, right? Hmm. As you would expect. But if the teams are really looking to get a competitive edge, they need to go down to those role players, those sort of borderline players, and figure out who are the guys there that are just giving you that slight edge, you know, from a borderline playoff team to a playoff team to a world champion, right? You know, that was David Ross. He doesn't show up as, you know, at the top of the leaderboard in our analysis. He's the guy that just, wow, he always beat expectations, right? And so it's that guy, those sort of diamonds in the rough that Kevin alluded to, that teams are going to have to take a chance on. That's where the leap of faith is. Nobody's going to – signing Mike Trout is not a leap of faith, right? So, but it's these other guys that kind of are on the borderline.
Well, I think that leads us nicely into our last question, which is a more forward-looking and even more forward-looking than we've been talking about, which is what's the goal? I mean, you've talked a little bit about working with teams and obviously helping them to identify some of these sort of mid-tier to lower-tier players. What are the goals? What do you think the future looks like for this idea of team synergy?
I can start on that. So, I mean, this kind of goes back to what we've said before, but, you know, I really do think, I guess, like I said, you know, people get really attached to this idea of chemistry as being something kind of indescribable. And so, you know, when you actually do start describing something to them, the reaction I got presenting it at Sloan was just like, that can't be right. Like they just really are, it's like they want the answer, but then they're just never going to be satisfied. So, I mean, the reality of research is like, you're kind of just moving the ball forward a little bit. You're trying to kind of push the frontier a little bit and then reevaluate where you're at. And I guess what we kind of said before, you know, the main takeaway I hope that we can contribute is that whole clubhouse chemistry idea, I have no doubt that that's important. I think I don't think there's anything controversial about understanding that as important, but if you really do want to insist that it's the big thing that we're missing, then you still have to have a way to understand how it translates to the field. So, that's kind of my hope, is that sort of gives some direction in terms of how people should be approaching chemistry and really kind of disciplining how they think about this, so that, you know, we don't have to give you something completely off base. We can kind of center you on something to try to convince people that this stuff really matters.
Yeah. I think the book, and it for us, and hopefully for you guys too, is a good exercise in, like, you know, communicating this idea, because it has so much power to it, I think. And I think the big part of Moneyball was not only saying, hey, look at all these great statistics, but getting people to embrace them and getting people to use them. And, you know, for what we're doing with Clubhouse stuff, what you guys are doing with Rhythm stuff, I think the idea of the book, the idea of this podcast really is just to find ways of communicating and find ways of sharing these ideas, because You know, we love this stuff. Like, we love doing this, and we'd love to, you know, put that idea out there and see if like teams could actually use it and see the potential of our work. I love what I think it was Scott who said in one of his drafts, high fives and butt slaps was a title that I want to borrow for the book, that or Clubhouse and Rhythm or something like that. But I think high fives and butt slaps might be the way to go. Can I?
Kevin deserves credit for that one. That was Kevin. Okay.
That's a good one.
I had the most visceral reaction with the how people thought about this stuff presenting at Sloan. So it's a personal line for me, we'll say.
You guys are brave for coming on the show, but you're really brave for just sort of teaming up with Ben and I, and the effort that you've put into writing this book. It gets us juiced. I think we're excited for our section. We're excited for the book altogether. And I think this is great. Like, I think this is good team chemistry along all fields of social science.
Bazinga!
Yeah, we're happy. We're happy to have you guys. These guys mean business. None of them are on Twitter, except for Andrew. Andrew, you're on Twitter. You're at RA Butters. Scott and Kevin are on LinkedIn, so you can find them.
I think Kevin said he's on Twitter. He's just a lurker, so we don't want to like.
This might be. It's yeah. I'm under firm enough wraps. I'm not worried, but maybe this is the incentive I need to get out there and start preaching the gospel about chemistry.
Anyone listening to this should at him right now.
Immediately.
I mean, if you find me, I'll go public. That's my
promise. There we go. You can find us on Twitter at @HeadGamePsych. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Brett Levine. You can find that guy on Twitter at BD Rosenberg PhD. And thanks as always for tuning in.